Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My guest today is Greg Mello, a founder and executive director of the Study Group, which studies the US nuclear weapons policy, the US nuclear weapons complex, and congressional education, community organizing, and litigation in this area. Greg's original education was in engineering and regional planning. For some years, he worked as a hydrogeologist in government and industry. And in 2002, Greg was a research fellow at Princeton's Program on Science and Global Security. Greg's research and analysis have been published in a variety of places, including the Washington Post and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Greg Mello, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Yes, thanks so much, Ellen.
Greg, so my initial questions are of a personal nature. How did you first become involved in this issue of nuclear weapons, and when did that happen?
You know, for many people, it's probably similar. It's hard to know when it all started.
Yeah.
Many of us grew up during the Cold War, and our basic attitudes were formed by what appeared to be the irrationality of the cultural response and to the arms race and its seemingly endless ramifications. And I was involved in interfaith work, as well as I was the first environmental inspector at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which brought me and my colleagues in the state government, face-to-face with the culture inside the nuclear weapons complex, which appalled all of us and was at such a lower level than anything we were encountering in our industrial site.
When was that, Greg? What year was it that you became an inspector at Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Complex?
That was in 1984, well,
Yeah, that's a long time ago. That's 26 years ago, right?
Yes.
And you were working with the state then, inspecting various facilities, were you?
Yes, I was.
And so, Greg, I'd be fascinated to know, and so would the listeners, I'm sure. Just give us a brief history of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Complex, how it was founded, and what it's done during its lifespan until now. It's going to have to be brief, obviously, but you can do that.
Sure. It started during the Manhattan Project. I think it was the fall of 42, or it could have been the very early spring of 43, when it was selected as the site for the final assembly of the design and final assembly of the first nuclear weapons. And construction began very quickly, and people started coming. What seemed to be a relatively simple problem became anything but, and instead of a few hundred people, it became a few thousand people. Facilities were built even during World War II to begin constructing nuclear bombs in large quantity for after the war. Then this was all very rushed, and nevertheless, a great deal of technical work was done in a short period of time.
And that was, wasn't it originally built at a site that was a small boys' school, and Robert Oppenheimer, who managed the Manhattan Project, the physicist, had lived in Los Alamos for some, New Mexico for some time, and he knew about that boys' school, and then they took the boys' school over in great secrecy, didn't they? And they made the first three nuclear weapons in Los Alamos, Greg?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And all that's exactly right. It was in some respects, except for its misogyny, a forward-looking, very forward-looking educational model involving a lot of outdoor experience. Today we call it a kind of permaculture school with technical training as well as outdoor experience.
And when you say misogyny, you mean it's dislike of the human race?
Oh, that school was they wanted to get these boys away from their maternal influences and make them tougher.
Uh-huh.
This was not long after Teddy Roosevelt, was setting a standard for what males should be in the United States. And so it was a school for relatively effete, rich children.
Yeah. And then it was turned into this vast nuclear weapons complex to manufacture the first three nuclear weapons before the end of the war in 1945, right?
Correct.
It
hasn't ever stopped growing, really.
So just give us a little brief rundown of, since 1945, what has Los Alamos Labs been up to, and about how much money has been spent by the taxpayers to uphold and advance, if you will, the goals of Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab.
Yes. Immediately after the war, Los Alamos was the main production site. Rocky Flats plant for making pits didn't exist, so Los Alamos made the pits. Then there's that project, that's the fissile cores of nuclear weapons.
What, the pit? Yes, describe what a pit is, actually, Greg Mello.
Well, a pit is in the beginning they weren't hollow, but a ball of plutonium or uranium or other fissile material, but those are the only two that have been used in the U.S. stockpile that we know of. It's at the heart of the first stage of a thermonuclear weapon, or could be a weapon in its own right. This was often the case. That was the case in the Fat Man bomb, the Nagasaki bomb. It's the most compact way to make a nuclear weapon, the lightest way. So that's the way they're all done now.
And so when it was just the pit itself and the Nagasaki bomb, that was plutonium, and that was an atomic bomb. But describe then, Greg, what a thermonuclear weapon or hydrogen bomb is using that pit.
Yes, a thermonuclear bomb would use that, an atomic bomb, as the first stage. And then the radiation from that bomb is used to compress and heat to really stellar temperatures the so-called secondary stage, which then initiates fusion of the light atoms, lithium and deuterium, and then we have an even more horrible explosion.
Yeah.
So Los Alamos is, in its first 11 years, it also developed and designed the first hydrogen bomb also.
Right. And wasn't that under the guidance of Edward Teller?
It was initially under the guidance, but there were perhaps other people more scientifically. I don't think his contribution was the primary scientific one, but it certainly was the primary bureaucratic or inspirational one. He pushed people to do this.
Yeah, Yes, against Robert Oppenheimer's better judgment, right?
Yes, and that of many other people once they realized it was possible.
So describe the power of an atomic bomb compared to conventional weapons, like the Hiroshima bomb perhaps, and then describe how big a hydrogen bomb can be. I mean, the explosive power of a large hydrogen bomb, Greg Mello.
Well, gosh, I guess I don't use firearms. Your listeners probably know more about this than I do, but the quantity of propellant is probably on the order of a gram or a couple grams, or a large bullet, maybe a few grams, I don't know. But 1,000 times more than that, of course, would be kilogram. A million times would be metric ton. A thousand of those, that would be, a billion times, order of magnitude, a billion times greater than a rifle bullet would be a 1 kiloton bomb, if I haven't made a mistake. That's a very small nuclear weapon.
A very small atomic bomb, yeah.
Yes, and so really we're talking about explosives that are, if you want to, atomic bombs are in the fielded generally with explosive power in the thousands of tons of conventional explosives range, and thermonuclear bombs in the, hundreds of thousands up to millions of tons of explosives. Beyond a certain point, they don't even, there's no limit in theory, but there's no use even in the most strange Lovian scenarios for very large bombs. So the largest bomb in the U.S. stockpile is just a little over 1 million tons of fuel.
And most of the bombs now in Russia and America, and they have the majority of nuclear weapons in the world, 97% of them, they're almost all hydrogen bombs, Greg?
Yes, they are. I'm not sure about every Russian bomb. There are some tactical Russian weapons which are very small, artillery shells, so I physically small as well as relatively small in yield. All U.S. nuclear weapons are thermonuclear weapons.
Hydrogen bombs. And
yes.
Capable of massive, massive explosions. So at the moment, it's true, isn't it, that America has more than 2,000 of these ghastly things on hair trigger alert. Would you like to describe to the audience what hair trigger alert means, Greg Mello?
Well, I'll try. That number sounds roughly right.
Mm.
Who knows, you know? We always, the experts in the field, I always have to catch myself saying, well, what do we really know for sure?
Because
well,
it's mostly secret, yeah.
Yeah. So the idea is if you have a silo, let's say, which contains a nuclear missile, you have, if you are a national command authority, and no one should think that only the President of the United States can launch these things, because, in fact, a lot of people can launch them.
Well, really? Like what sort of people can launch them, Greg?
Well, they delegate this authority down the line because the travel time of missiles from submarines off the coast, east coast of the United States to Washington, D.C. is very short.
How short?
How short? Mm-hmm. Less than 10 minutes, certainly.
10 minutes.
So the likelihood of the president surviving a so-called decapitating first strike is very small.
Uh-huh.
So obviously other people can launch nuclear weapons.
Which other people?
People in the U.S. Strategic Command, and I could be mistaken about this, but I think some of the regional the regional commanders, like head of CENTCOM, others who have nuclear weapons in their custody, and I think that, but these orders are only activated when they can't reach anybody. So I hope, and I assume, and I hope, and I'm not really an expert in nuclear command and control, but that there is a relatively orderly delegation, although what orderly means in the context of nuclear war, we don't know.
Yeah.
But the point is that if a missile is perceived as coming, then somebody has to make a decision. The general assumption and what they've said is that they will launch their missiles from the bases in the Midwest when they perceive the missiles coming, because
from Russia, yeah,
because the missiles won't be around to launch after the incoming bombs hit them. Warheads.
So
there's only a few minutes to make this sort of decision,
whether to blow up the planet or not.
Yes, the president gets, I think, a multiple choice kind of A, B, C, D response. The notion that there's going to be a lot of deep thought when the president is told that he's got 3 minutes to live, that's kind of silly.
Yeah, but it's realistic, isn't it? And I think that the ABC choice is not whether or not to launch America's weapons, but it's whether to have a first strike to hit the Russian missile silos, or a counterforce to hit the Russian cities of populations greater than 100,000 or more, or whether to do both, counterforce, which is against the missile silos, and
countervalue.
Yeah, countervalue, that's the cities, counterforce and countervalue. So we're still talking about what, do Russia and America have an overkill now of about five times? In other words, they can overkill every person on Earth about five times, is that right?
Well, it's as you know, the ash, the soot that that made of our bodies and our houses and
cities,
everything else in our cities, that is lifted up by these enormous explosions. People have to understand that when a very great explosion like this occurs in the air above a city, almost everything bursts into flame, no matter what the weather. So the radiation intensity is so great that everything bursts into flame. It goes through the windows of houses, which, of course, break soon after. And a massive sea of fire engulfs about everything. It goes much farther out than the blast of the bomb itself. These massive seas of fire waft all the material that is in a city very high into the stratosphere.
Like the volcano, right?
Yes, exactly. Like the volcano, only much higher than this recent Icelandic eruption. The expected height from a burning city where a fire is ignited over several square miles, those go much higher and circle the Earth, and unfortunately, soot stays up there a long time. And it, as far as anyone can tell, and there's been a lot of high-quality work on this, the Earth will cool dramatically after that and stay cold for a few years.
An ice age.
Meaning that no one will have anything to eat.
Well, and people will freeze to death starving in the dark, right?
Basically, and they may well be blind, because the gases which are taken up there will destroy the ozone layer. So animals and people will, unless unless people are extremely careful, and how careful you can be under those circumstances is kind of,
it's a crazy
silly concept. Subject.
Yeah.
Yeah. People go blind very fast.
Yeah, that's if they're alive. Well, so we're talking about nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth, and that could happen. I mean, on 9/11, I went to the Strategic Air Command website, and for a couple of days, they said that their state of alert went from DEFCON 5, which is the lowest state of alert, to DEFCON 1, I think, which is the highest state of alert before the button is pressed by the president, because no one knew what was going on. And in that situation, as you know, a terrorist attack, not even with weapons, could have triggered the end of life on Earth, right? So we're in a very, very nefarious and fragile situation.
Well, it is more fragile than people realize. In fact, it's become more fragile, I would say, in the last 10 years.
Why?
Because we, during the Cold War, there really wasn't any material competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. Each country could grow its economy and pursue its political ambitions domestically without coming into direct competition for material resources around the world. We are now entering a period where there aren't enough resources to sustain economic growth as we know it, or at all, for everybody.
In the developed world.
What's that? For the developed world, yeah. That's right, which consumes the lion's share of the world's resources.
Yeah.
So the conflict under these conditions could, in the coming decade, especially the latter part of the coming decade, there could be quite a lot of tension. And people don't realize that when you have a nuclear deterrent posture, the signals and intent that people make could entrap a country into greater and greater belligerence in order to maintain their face, you might call it. I think the United States, we saw this in Vietnam, what we'd be willing to do in order not to lose face under those circumstances. And things could very quickly get out of control. So it behooves us to try to move nuclear weapons out of their central place in foreign policy of the main nuclear powers, while we have a period of relative tranquility.
Right. So I'm interviewing, by the way, Greg Mello, who is a founder and executive director of the study group, which mostly studies the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab in New Mexico. So that brings me on, you know, to the nuclear posture review, which has just been released by the Pentagon, written mostly by the Pentagon, but under Obama's administration. And these nuclear posture reviews are produced every 5 years by the Pentagon. And as I read about the nuclear posture review, it seemed that America is still extremely belligerent, that it will use nuclear weapons if necessary to maintain its global empire, and it is a global empire. And it will use nuclear weapons on little countries that maybe are making chemical weapons or biological or possibly nuclear weapons. It seems to me, Greg Mello, that nothing has changed under the Obama administration, even though President Obama would like to abolish nuclear weapons throughout the world, and I give him credence for that. As I read the new nuclear posture review and the New START treaty, which is the agreement between Russia and America about nuclear weapons, you've written here, is it continuity or is it change? Is it progress or is it regression? Would you like to outline, Greg Mello, essentially what the Nuclear Posture Review says and also what the New START Treaty between Russia and America means?
Yes, that's a tall order, but maybe a little caricature to try anyway.
Yeah.
As you were talking, I was reflecting on what is that, what is continuity and what is retrogression. And I wonder sometimes if trying to merely maintain a stable situation, a stable nuclear posture in the face of deteriorating overall economic, political, environmental situation, is that not a serious form of regression? In other words, the only way to keep the status quo is to constantly try to move beyond it. And but to get to the point, the Obama Nuclear Posture Review attempts to keep the nuclear status quo as much as possible while explaining it in an idealistic language. So under the previous president, George Bush, there was a lot of hawkish language, which none of us appreciated. But the reality is that his most hawkish nuclear policies were not passed by Congress. There was a Democratic opposition that was reasonably effective, and some of the opposition was Republican also. But under Obama, we're seeing basically many of the Bush proposals repackaged under different language, and we don't see the congressional opposition that we saw before. Many of the NGOs are confused. It's a very, very confusing period. And as for the yes, we are retaining. In fact, we're rolling back some of the protections that were given to non-nuclear weapon states in the past. Those protections are not as strong under Obama. They're more overt nuclear threats than there were. So that's a change. The nuclear weapons arsenal is not materially changed at all, except that the qualitative improvement of the arsenal, both in the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense, has been accelerated. That is because the reasons for that are partly because Hawks and the Democratic Party want this, and the other reason is because if President Obama wants to get treaties ratified in the present U.S. Senate, he has got to offer enormous blandishment to the most hawkish members of the Senate. And this has caused him to make a number of unilateral hawkish vectors, you might say, in the nuclear weapons field in an attempt to placate these right-wing senators. It's not working particularly, and the cost of it all is alarming a lot of people in Congress, and both the and for us, the content of the policies seems really regressive.
As I look at it, Greg Mello, I'm astounded. If you look at it as a physician, which I am, trying to understand human behavior, this is absolute insanity. To have this huge nuclear arsenal, which somehow the public has been placated over the years to accept that annihilation could occur any minute, number one. Number two, all they talk about, it seems now, is terrorist bombs. Well, so we have one bomb that blows up New York. So what? We're talking about 40 hydrogen bombs at the moment targeted on New York, and as many on Washington, and all over the world indeed, Europe and England and Canada and Australia and America and China and Russia. So it seems like we're practicing displacement activity by worrying about terrorist activities. And that's what happens when you put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation. They run away and do something irrelevant to that which threatens them. Would you agree with that analysis, Greg Mello?
I certainly would. Yeah. One of my board members puts it this way. We're all the emphasis is on nuclear weapons, which in the case of the terrorist nuclear weapons which don't exist. Meanwhile, we've got tens of thousands of nuclear weapons which do exist.
I just can't understand the mentality of these men who parade around in Washington in their suits and ties or with their stripes and stars on their lapels or their epaulets and the like. If you had to psychoanalyze them, you know, they really need to be, and this is not too harsh, to be put into a mental hospital. I mean, and the fact that we all accept the status quo, especially now when the Cold War is over, and Hillary Clinton marching around the world, you know, telling Iran better behave itself because everything's on the table. And even Obama said that. It more than takes my breath away. And I think it's time we got going again, Greg, when we had 80% of Americans in the 80s supporting an end to the nuclear arms race. We had some impact. We did help to end the Cold War, and Gorbachev and Reagan got together. But everything is so silent now. I suppose it's like having a mentally sick person in your family or an alcoholic, and you cover everything up and pretend everything is normal when the family's disintegrating.
Yes. We could have a long conversation about the social and political conditions which make it more difficult to mobilize people, but I don't think that's quite to the point. I think we can talk ourselves out of the personal commitment that we, each of us, need to make. And, you know, nuclear weapons are in this country, and, you know, I've got 2,000 of them, I'm looking toward them right now out the window of our office.
Really? You mean in the bunkers in the mountains surrounding Albuquerque?
Yes.
2,000 of them.
They're about 5 miles. Yeah, about 5 miles from here.
Really?
Yesterday I, you know, was hiking in the mountains, the foothills, and looked down on them. There they are down there. You can see the nice little trees where the around the entrance to the bunker. They're quite real, and they are one of the threats we have right now. And I think that speaking of, you know, when we talk about mental health, for all of us, we have to assess whether we're going to just be passive in the face of the terrible climate problems, with the impact of which falls so heavily on the poor, the nuclear weapons issue, and underneath the cloud of the mushroom cloud of nuclear weapons is the terrible conventional weapon wars which are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in our age, mental health comes from realizing that we have to protect people. We have to protect the kids.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that, well,
and
you,
very frequently.
Yeah.
I think you can see people realize sometimes that, hey, there's nobody else doing this. The people we imagine having more power in society, having more money, for one reason or another, they're not engaged. And so the burden falls on many people many of us who might, if, you know, left to ourselves, think, gosh, well, I'm not the one who should do this. Well, who is?
Yeah, I think Martin Luther King, to paraphrase what he said, once said that if you don't have an issue that you're prepared to die for, you're not really living.
That's beautiful.
I guess that's true for you, and I guess that's true for me. I've had at least 8 death threats, and so what's my life compared to possibly the only life in the universe? But let's get off the philosophizing now, Greg Mello. The New START treaty between Russia and America really does virtually nothing, right, in the reduction of nuclear weapons between them?
Yes, that's right. And I was speaking with someone in government in Washington a couple of weeks ago who is in the administration, and he said, it's just optics, all optics. In other words, it's all for show.
All for show, optics.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's, he said, not worth the ratification cost.
No.
And that's our view here at the Los Alamos Study Group also. It's not very popular, but...
It's true, though. It's true, yeah. Go on.
When you look at what the Senate is demanding for ratification of this treaty, it's almost unlimited.
In terms of?
What's that?
Almost unlimited in terms of?
Let's see. We're already, let's see. I told you if I look south, I see, I can almost see the 2,000 nuclear weapons down there in the bunker at Kirtland Air Force Base. I see through the neighborhood here and down the street. But looking north, about 90 miles as the crow flies, about $5 billion in investment in new plutonium manufacturing facilities are underway. That $5 billion in investment is just a down payment. It's just, comparable investments are being made at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to make the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear part of the bomb. These up here are for the plutonium part. But Senator Kyle said recently, we need an extra $12 to $15 billion beyond anything Obama has already started. And we need, he said, to make sure that we're going to be modernizing our nuclear arsenal continuously,
what?
Or you won't get Republican votes for the START treaty.
What does modernizing nuclear weapons mean, Greg Mello?
It means different things to different people, but...
Does it mean the old ones won't work?
No, it doesn't mean the old ones won't work. It means that unless there's a kind of churning, like butter churning of the arsenal, then the people, then there's no work at the giant nuclear lab.
For whom?
Not enough work. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, you said not enough work. Work for whom? What people there won't be enough work for? Who are these people?
Well, here at Los Alamos Lab, we employ a lot more people than we ever did during the Cold War.
Really?
Many more people, a lot more money. There's about 14,000 people working there.
14,000, wow.
Just at this one site. There are 8 sites altogether, although that's the largest. The Obama is planning a 22% increase in the budget of Los Alamos Lab in a single year. That's a bigger increase than at any time since the Manhattan Project, since World War II.
Well, who on earth convinced Obama to spend that obscene amount of money on these obscene, almost incomprehensible weapons?
Well, he left many of the Bush appointees in place,
yeah,
such as Robert Gates at the Pentagon.
Uh-huh.
There have over the years a number of mistaken ideas about how much money we need to spend on all this, and everyone is seems like you can resolve different political differences with a little bit more money. That's the theory. So the money has gone up ever since 1995. Went up under Clinton, then it went up under Bush. It fell a little bit during the last part of the Bush administration because they were spending so much money on the wars and they were worried about the deficit. But now it is surging up again.
Well, so these scientists, I've seen them in Congress. They have captured the energy of the sun by splitting the atom. And actually, I realized the other day, I don't know if it was a dream or not, but if there's a nuclear war, we'll have small suns exploding all over our planet. And they have a sort of an aura like Merlin, like a wizard, and they come into Congress, and most of the Congress people are scientifically literate, and they virtually put the red carpet down and lie down in front of them because they're sort of magical men, and they get whatever they want. I think this dynamic needs to be analyzed too, don't you think, Greg Mello?
I certainly do. I was reading a speech of one revered Boulder Cold Warrior, and I know that he's very greatly respected. And, you know, I respect him also as much as anybody, but the speech was just, there was almost nothing there. But because he comes, one congressional staff member told me that, referring to this individual, that he carries the DNA of the Cold War, of the old AEC, and that's why he's so respected.
What's his name?
Oh, I'm not going to say.
Here, oh, please.
there wasn't much to the speech. It didn't really, you know, it's about a high school level.
Yeah.
Speech.
All right. Now, we've talked in general terms about the Los Alamos Labs, and I've been up there. It's a very scary place, and there's plutonium, which is the most carcinogenic material in the world, in the, the crevices around there and the cliffs and stuff. They've just dumped nuclear waste all over the place, and it's getting into the river and polluting downstream Indian tribes and the like. I mean, I could go on, but let's go to a broader issues. You've got a question here. Practically speaking, how can citizens respond to this? Well, it's pure evil. And how can we avoid being pawns of this evil?
It's a very good question. And I think that the answer lies in the resolution with which we face the issues. First of all, we want to face material facts and not get swept away in anybody's rhetoric.
Propaganda.
The propaganda fountains are at their maximum right now. And seems like people are throwing around phrases like nuclear abolition that used to really have a meaning.
Uh-huh.
But now you have to ask yourself, what do you mean this year? What do you mean next year? Where's the nuclear abolition? You're telling us that you're going to get to nuclear abolition by a massive increase in spending on nuclear weapons and pushing forward all of these modernization projects. How does that bring us to our goal? And so that's the first thing. For people outside the United States, I know this is a little simplistic, but the United States really needs to be stopped.
Yep.
The nuclear industry in the United States is part of and tied with the broader imperialist agenda, you might say, that's really quite dangerous for everybody. And it's an increasing danger because our actual power in the world, if you want to measure that, say, economically, is declining. So there's a greater misunderstanding within the imperial capital, you might say, about what the United States can get away with in the world, which I think is dangerous. The sooner we can bring the United States to a realization that it is one country among other countries and not the world's controller, the happier and better we'll all be.
Well, and how then, the obvious practical question is, Greg Mello, how can we all stop being pawns of this system and do what we did in the 80s and rise up and stop it? Close down the labs.
Well, we need, I've been reflecting here. We live in a state which is almost, politics are almost completely given over to support of this industry.
In New Mexico.
In New Mexico.
Mm.
And we need to basically ask ourselves whether we're serious or not, and graduate from what I often hear: should we go meet with our congressman or senator? Should we write a letter?
Mm.
No, you really shouldn't. Don't waste your time. Move. Look at what's in your life. Look at how to liberate some time. Meet with your friends. See if you can support someone full time. And talk about, sure, meet with your senator's staff. But if they don't respond, then you have to begin the process of nonviolent communication.
Meaning,
we need to start talking about sitting in their offices, about picketing, about using the entire toolkit of methods that have been bequeathed to us by the movements of the past. And above all, I think we can anchor these in the real cry for change in climate, in the here in this country. And I think it's probably not too dissimilar in Australia right now, but the middle class is the poor and the middle class are increasingly having to bear the burden of these terrible military priorities. We're spending an enormous amount on the military, and what used to be something that people used to think that they could afford to send their children to college. So this has become more and more the province of the wealthy.
Mm.
The kids here at the university, which are nearby, they're in deep debt by the time they graduate. A lot of them are.
Mm. We need to mobilize the youth. I've been thinking about this very carefully, Greg, because Generation X, Y, and Z, they don't tend to read newspapers, the New York Times, etc. They don't watch the news. They're Twittering and digging and Facebooking and the like. And there must be a way, because it's their future. I mean, you know, I'm 72 now and I won't be around much longer, but it's their future. And it's their future in terms of global warming and this dreadful, dreadful nuclear Armageddon that hangs above us, like the sword of Damocles. And if we can mobilize them, because kids have a lot of courage and they don't see problems, they just see solutions about what they're going to do. And consequently, I'm setting up a new sort of organization with a new web page called A Nuclear Free Planet to involve the kids and get on YouTube and all sorts of things, because the way we've gone about our work over the past decades, Greg Mello, I think has almost had its time. And unless we have another arrow to our bow, so to speak, or string to our bow, we're not going to succeed. And I know that there's such passion and energy and joy and purity amongst the younger kids that if we can mobilize that, we might be able to save the planet. Would you agree with that?
I certainly would. And really the partnership between people who have experience like yourself And the young people who have, they do indeed have all those qualities, which you know, in the first world, people get trapped by their lives, and we live in a very decadent culture. What can I say?
Yeah.
And young people have not, they're not as deeply compromised. And I think we have a cultural survival, cultural transmission problem to work on at the same time. So there's a deeply conservative aspect to this, as well as a radical one, and the two aren't really different anymore.
No, so Greg Mello, tell us what you think is going to happen at the upcoming Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference in New York, which is just about to get launched by Ban Ki-moon, who's the head of the United Nations, and Obama, etc. Do you think that this conference involving all the world's nations is going to achieve anything?
Well, if we step back a little bit, if it achieves something, it will achieve it through civil society, I think, primarily. Those who are moved because of what of the interactions they have, the idea that there's going to be a sudden change in the world order in a few days, I don't think that's going to happen.
It's really ironic, though, isn't it, Greg Mello, when you think back to when Reagan and Gorbachev met at Reykjavik in 1988. Over a weekend, two mere mortal men almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons between Russia and America. I mean, it actually, that gave us an insight into what could be achieved, what idealistically it could be achieved.
That's right.
Yeah.
Like you, I believe in the freedom of individual moral actors. You know, even if we meet them, even in the heart of the weapons complex, people who are weighing what they do and trying to work with as much integrity as they can, sometimes not in... sometimes their humane values undermine what they're supposed to be doing in their jobs, and much depends on people making those kind of moral decisions.
It certainly does. And to finish our interview, Greg Mello, I'd like you to talk about Israel and the role it's playing in this nuclear issue in the world at the moment, please.
Well, it's terribly important, and I'm really glad you brought it up because it's often forgotten, even especially by me or even by you. Israel is a country with a lot of advanced nuclear weapons.
How many do you think?
Somewhere on the order of 200. Many as they need. As many as Britain... it's a nuclear power just like Britain, France, or China.
Yep.
And it is in a state of hostility with its neighbors and is attempting to basically strangle the people from whom the land for the country was taken. And this incredibly unjust situation, which is played out year after year, impedes and affects every aspect of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. Egypt will, at this upcoming conference, will make a major point of Israel's nuclear arsenal. I mean, Egypt, as the head of the non-aligned movement, which is 118 countries, and it's a very valid point. And I guess there's really hardly anything more central to unraveling the nuclear nonproliferation problems we face than the problem of Israel.
Yeah, and Israel will neither confirm nor deny it has nuclear weapons. Some people say up to 400 it has. It has not signed the non-proliferation treaty. Neither has India nor Pakistan. On the other hand, North Korea had. I think it's backed out of it now. And Iran signed the non-proliferation treaty. So there are contradictions really everywhere you look in this horrible political nuclear situation. I just wish, Greg, that you and I could be at the NPT conference where we could address the whole plenary session and just, you know, pull the wool from the eyes and just speak the absolute stark truth. But, of course, that won't happen.
Well, that would be wonderful. I mean, we have there's a few people like yourself in the past who are really, their proper role has been a real sort of globe-spanning one. And yet we risk right now in the present climate, we have to pay attention to really localized and humbled levels. As I'm quoting here from another of my board members, that because we have such a propaganda environment at the level of international politics, where the concrete effects of all this occur are in local areas.
Yeah, grassroots.
Any place USA.
Yeah. Well, we have to end our discussion now, Greg Mello. I would just like to say that if you would like me to come back to New Mexico, which is called the National Sacrifice State because it's so radioactive and the like from previous tests, I'd be happy to come and stir the bushes, so to speak, and help you if possible. We all need to band together now because it's really beyond the point where we can sit back and philosophize. We have to act, as you've just been saying. So I want to I want to thank you, Greg, so much for coming on the program. We didn't cover much of your extraordinary in-depth expertise about the labs and what they're up to, and maybe we'll have another conversation in the near future to do that, Greg.
Thank you very much, Helen.
My guest today was Greg Mello, a founder and executive director of the study group in New Mexico, which mainly studies the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab and other nuclear weapons labs around the nation of the United States of America. Thank you for listening. I think a very important program in terms of survival of all of us. Let's have another discussion next week. Goodbye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.